Hello, nurses and friends of nurses. Yakko Warner here, and you're listening to a podcast on the Geekcast Radio Network. Lucky you.
Hello, and welcome to episode 210 of the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today, as the usual, is the Comic Concierge, Dan. How are we doing today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing good. We're back from a little bit of I had to do like a brief week hiatus here because I was out of the country and doing some work things, and it was a blur the last week, and then I have some family in town for 2 weeks, so was not able to rewatch the film that we're covering today in time, so I asked for an audible, and Dan was good enough to comply with that. So now we're back to continue our Alfred Hitchcock retrospective, I guess you could call it. We've covered a handful of his movies so far. I think we're right about the halfway point here with the 10 films we're going to be covering. And today we are moving on to probably one of his most well-known films, the 1954 mystery thriller Rear Window. So as we talked about briefly at the end of the last episode, we have both seen this one. This is one of two, I think, that we have both seen prior to this. But give me what your experience is with Rear Window. How long had it been since you'd watched it? How many times have you seen it? And kind of what was the set the stage for going into this rewatch?
It's been about a decade or so since I watched last watched Rear Window. Oddly enough, I watched it the first time when I was recovering from surgery and I had nothing, you know, so I was just watching movies, and it was one that, I was trying to go through, like, you know, the best movies of all time. And of course this is on it. So yeah, it's been about 10 years or so since I've last seen it. So, I kind of remembered a good amount of it, but there's a lot that I didn't remember. So it was fun revisiting it because it's I'm a different movie goer now than I was a decade ago.
Yeah, I was interested to revisit this one as well. It's probably been even more than 10 years for me since I had seen this one. Amanda saw this one in either high school or college, and I actually had to analyze it and do some, like, so she remembered it like the back of her hand. But for myself, it had been, I want to say, closer to 15 years, maybe, if not 20. My mom and I, once upon a time, were trying to go through some of the AFI top 100 list just as a thing to do. And we had watched maybe, I don't know, I think we only got through like 6 or 10 of the ones that were blind spots, but this was one of them. So I was very interested to revisit this one now, given the fact of, you know, how many movies you and I have both probably seen in the last decades, you know, doing these podcasts and things of that nature. So it's kind of coming at it, like you said, as a different moviegoer. And then on top of that, doing it in the series that we're doing it now, where we've just watched a number of Hitchcock films, I was interested to see kind of how that would impact this viewing. So I was definitely very interested in this rewatch, and I thought it added to like the fun of being able to rewatch this, because there was definitely things, like vague things or structure things, that I remembered and knew were coming, or this, that, and the other. But a lot of the details I didn't 100% remember going into it. So it was just as effective this time as it was the first time for me, as far as like the guessing game and keeping me, like, you know, not 100% sure on how everything was going to go to the detail. So I'm getting into this one a little bit. This is written by John Michael Hayes. Like a lot of the Alfred Hitchcock films, it's based off of something else, whether it be a play, a novel, short story, etc. So this one's based on a 1942 short story entitled It Had to Be Murder. And then obviously Hitchcock does his stuff to it and adjusted and changed it, as did John Michael Hayes, I'm sure, in the screenplay development, writing, etc. So this one's going to star a couple people that we have seen already. So Jimmy Stewart, which obviously we saw in Rope, and Grace Kelly, which we saw in Dial M for Murder, which we've covered during this series. And then a few other main characters. Wendell Corey obviously is playing the detective or the police officer in this one. Lieutenant Tom Doyle, and then Thelma Ritter is playing Stella, the nurse. So those are like the four characters that we see the most in Jeffrey's apartment. And then we'll get into some of the other characters that we see that are not in his apartment that we're watching throughout this time. So what was your initial reaction on this rewatch? Did it work for you as much, or what was your take?
Yeah, obviously going into a movie like Rear Window, that is, like as you mentioned, we saw before, it's noted as one of the greatest movies of all time. Now, it's like, you know, is it good or bad? Feels like you almost like there's a different kind of conversation, because it's like, why is this looked at as such a good movie? Is it deserving? All that. And it's interesting going through all these movies that we've gone through so far and kind of comparing it to what we've seen, because it's interesting the way that Hitchcock is able to like create suspense, because in this, like watching it this time, I kind of remembered elements of the plot. I thought there was more of a twist at the end. Like, I couldn't remember, like, was there? I kept thinking there was more of a twist. Not that that's a bad thing, but watching it a second time, I just marveled at, like, the creation of it in a way, in the sense of just, like, this set and, like, being amazed at its design. Because that's all, and that is what makes this movie, really, you know? It's such a weird movie to be allotted the way it is, because in reality not a lot happens here. It's literally a guy looking out his window and you know, seeing kind of the lives of individuals in ways people aren't used to. But I just found that part fascinating, and I do think it's interesting in a way that it speaks to this like universal truth that's still, you know, an issue today, where there is, you know, people have or are very meticulous in the how they present themselves to people outside of their comfort zone. And like, people can be a very different person when they don't think anyone's watching, and you see that here, obviously. You know, where people are acting certain ways that clearly they wouldn't do it. Sometimes it's obviously criminal, sometimes it's simply just kind of awkward. But I just thought, even all this time ago, all this time later, that, and then of course you do have the suspense part. Like, that was like what I was least interested in. Not that it was that, you know, all these other movies that has been kind of the focal point, but I just found what it was saying, the creation of it, how even like all the music is within the set. Like, there's no score here outside of what you hear the music playing besides the beginning of it. Like, all the way it's all put together is so fascinating to me. And I think all that still maintains all this time later. So I was thwarted by it. I probably all the movies we watched so far, I liked it the first time I saw it, but the second time, I think I saw for why it was and why it has been allotted far more seeing it again than they did the first time.
Yeah, you brought up a lot of good points here. I feel like you're reading my notes I've jotted down here a little bit. But I am, like, as I've said before, probably in some of these episodes, I'm a different type of film goer than others, like, especially like critics. Like, I don't necessarily, I guess, consider myself a film critic like that, because film critics know a lot more about the making of film and like everything that goes into it. And I'm more of someone that just, I guess I'm dumbed down or whatever, but I like the dialogue. I like the performances. I like the story, the plot, the twists, all of that type of stuff. And I'm never someone that's like overly concerned or even like cognizant of the making of the film in a way. Like, a lot of times the set design and the musical aspects of it, the score, like, that's like the last thing that I will notice in a film, like, traditionally, I guess. And I found myself, like you, just marveling at the making of this film. And that's something that's really weird for me to say, I guess. But like, what you're talking about, like, this set, the creation of it, and obviously there's been a lot written and there's been a lot of documentaries and specials and stuff about this film that you can go and find. I actually did watch this on a masterpiece collection, and it did have a couple of different bonus features that go into some of the making, and there's a different things that you can watch. Well, I watched a few of them. I didn't watch all of them. I didn't have time to do the whole movie again with commentary on it or stuff like that, but some of the making of it, and it is just like a marvel. Like, the fact that they were trying to create this setting that was not possible on any type of studio, they had to kind of think outside the box. And basically, the story that was on one of these special features was like, the one guy was trying to, and I'm not going to have the names or what position they were, but somebody involved in the production was basically communicating with somebody else and trying to figure out how they were going to pull this off. And the one of the guys basically says, like, well, what if we like use the basement, the floor, you know, beneath the floor in the studio that's usually used, you know, for whatever storage or whatever else it was. And they're like, well, they're never going to go for it. Like, but let's ask them. And then they went for it. So they basically used like the basement of this plane, opened it up so that they could have, and they like went all the way up into like the lighting, the rafters of the lighting and stuff like this to create this whole scale. And like, just the way that that's done and the way that like, you know, you're looking at a set, right? Like a lot of Hitchcock films, it has the feeling of watching a play, right? We've mentioned that a number of different times where it's something that you can tell is a very constrained set, like a one, or a lot of his films don't have a lot of extra locations, right? Where like we're just watching it in a room, like with a rope, or we're just watching it mainly in one room, like Dial M for Murder. So there's not, you know, he does this a lot, and you have that feeling like, oh, I could be watching this on a stage in a way. And so it does that, but then like just the way he does the different moves of the camera, the way he's filming this, like the perspective that he's using, you know, the lighting that they had set up, like they basically had this whole thing set up with four different settings for their lights, almost like think of it almost like a modern thing where you had four different switches on your light and you can do daytime, afternoon, evening, and nighttime without any, you know, relighting or re-rigging. So it made it a lot different for them to like film it in that way and a lot easier. And I guess all of the apartments that are in here are livable. Like it even said that I believe the dancer, Miss Torso, like was said to quote unquote live in that apartment the whole month that they were shooting. And like they said that most of the apartments were livable. They had running water, they had electricity, they had different stuff. So like all of the meticulous detail that went into this is just amazing. And I feel like you could watch it a number of different times and just keep picking up on some of the other type of stuff that goes along with not only the camera movements and the lighting, but like you said, the score, where basically the score is like the intro song and the outro song, which is kind of in conjunction with the Lisa song. Is that what the name of the song is at the end? Yeah, Lisa. Other than that, it's all, like you said, it's all diegetic. It's all people talking. It's all the sounds that you would hear in this courtyard. It's music that's playing in some of the apartments, and the clever way that they kind of build all of that in. Like, it's just it's a marvel. Like, I really liked this the first time, borderline loved this the first time. And I came out of this one, this rewatch, like somehow loving it even more. Like, it's to me, deserves all of the stuff like you were talking about. Like you said, obviously, it's talked about as one of the best films. Like, you know, I think it's been on the AFI top 100 list every time that's come out. It usually ranks somewhere in, I think, the 40s. Metacritic, it's one of those rare films that has 100 out of 100. For some reason on Rotten Tomatoes, it only has a 98%. We won't call out those two people that said something bad about it, but it'd be shocking to me to rank this film under, isn't the Rotten Tomatoes percent, like as long as it's above like a 50, it counts as a positive?
60%.
60? Like, so somebody, yeah. There's a couple people out here that rank this lower than 60%.
I think it's whatever, I think it depends upon whatever the person's ranking is, because like if it's,
gotcha, you know, five like, stars or something,
yeah,
yeah, yeah,
but yeah, for way. It to be for it to be fresh, it has to be 60%, which is to me like weird, because if it's whatever,
Rotten Tomatoes is weird, but anyway, so obviously it's very well appreciated. It has been over the years. So like I did read a couple of the reviews. I know that's kind of jumping ahead, we'll get back into the story and some of the characters and stuff like that, but just kind of since we've been talking about how it was received, I did read a couple of the initial reviews. Some of it's on Wikipedia, some of it's on IMDb, and you can seek them out elsewhere as well. But two different things that are somewhat interesting that I caught my eye, like Time, for example, said it's, and this was at the time it was released, just possibly the second most entertaining picture ever made by Hitchcock. Did you see or read this to see what they were saying was the first?
I saw some reviews, but I didn't see this one, no.
So it said just possibly the second most entertaining picture ever made by Hitchcock, and then in parentheses had the 39 Steps.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. So that's an interesting take back in the 50s. And then there's another guy that was writing for the New York Times, and I'm going to disagree with this 100%, but he said, this film is not significant. What it has to say about people and human nature is superficial and glib.
Yeah, I could see where that's coming from. If you're not really, I think looking at, I think you're. I don't think he was looking deep enough. Regarding it, because I think it is saying. I think maybe that person doesn't. Yeah, because
maybe in the time, but maybe at the time it didn't. Like, I feel like watching this today, for some reason, like, was even more impactful. I obviously was not alive in 1950. I have no idea what the impact was there, but I'm like, wow, like the connections to like what you were talking about, like, especially with social media and technology.
Yeah.
Like, it is exactly what you're saying. Like the image people put out in public is similar to like the image that they put on Facebook, right? Or social media. Like, they post the good stuff, right? They post the highlights. It's like a highlight reel. They're not posting the arguments they have. They're not posting the fights they have, or when they're, you know, down and out, or that type of stuff. So it's like very similar to how people live life through the internet and through social media. And then this is pulling back the curtain on that. But I think too, like the speech that the owner of the dog gives.
Yeah.
After, I don't think we can spoil Rear Window, can we?
I don't think so. I think it's
okay. So obviously, after something happens to her dog, like the speech she gives about not knowing each other, not knowing your neighbors, you know, loving the neighbor by like themselves, or you know, all of that type of stuff is like hearing that coming from a film in 1954 and thinking about how society is today, where we just keep getting further and further from where people even know their neighbors or feel comfortable being outside or things like that. I was like, my goodness, this film is timeless. But
I also think of, that's a good point too. And it's interesting too, because you think about like, you really couldn't do this movie today because one, people don't have their windows open. It's everyone's low. Like, you can't. At a far, if you were just to look at it, you'd be like, oh, well, look at how friendly that neighborhood is. People, because everyone's like out and seemingly connected, but you kind of see that's not the case. But and especially to me, the scene that said a lot was Miss Lonely Hearts. I think there's a lot with her character where you have that really sad sequence where, you know, she's getting ready for this dinner, going through these all this motion, and you realize that it's not for anyone. She's just playing a game for herself, which is like, oh. And then obviously, you know, you see she finally, of course, is able to have someone over, and that doesn't go well. I do think like the way that they were so slow to react to what she was doing and potentially, you know, taking her own life. I'm like, you could act a little bit. You could walk over there.
It's an emergency here, people.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, it's like, they're just like, let's play it out. Let's see how this goes. Which again, I think speaks to those individuals, which I think, you know, that reviewer is right. It is glib, but I think in a way there is honesty there. And maybe that was part of, you know, that, maybe that is the way a lot of people are, unfortunately.
I thought too, it was interesting. Like, I'd have to do some deeper dives and like some more analysis, but I feel like it very, very carefully. And I don't know if every one of these neighbors, I haven't done the like research to find out like from the short story, which ones of these neighbors existed in the short story, which ones were made up for the film or in the screenplay, et cetera. So I'm sure some existed, some didn't, whatever. But like, I feel like whether it was credit to the short story or whether it's credit to the screenwriter or Hitchcock himself, but the way that they pick out where each of these, I guess, apartments, for lack of a better term, because some are couples and some are single people, but like how each one represents a different time or a different segment of like the development of relationships. Because you have like the newlyweds, right? So you have that going. You have a couple that is in that stage, not that all couples go through this, but you have a couple that's in a stage where they're obviously not getting along with each other for whatever the case may be, whether there's infidelity, whether there's nagging or arguments or stuff like that. Like, you have that, right? You have like the bachelor that hasn't even met anybody yet. From what it seems like with the piano player and the musician, right? You have the Miss Lonely Heart, who seems like she's probably already either never had that relationship or had a relationship that is no longer in existence whether it be through divorce or death or whatever. Like, it seems like every one of these groups is like another part of this, like another stage of life. And it, I feel like it's interesting how they all kind of, it could be the, it could almost be the same character in all of these things, just at different moments in their life. I mean, not 100%, but like it gave me that feeling too, where you're like, oh, these people are in different stages of the development, the natural evolution of relationships in a way. And I thought that was kind of interesting, or just different types of relationships and how they depict all that. Like, I think there's so much you can take away and analyze on this, that it's something that comes across as way more than superficial, I guess. That would not be the word that I would necessarily use, not to go too much into that review. But getting back into like the different groups of people and the different characters slash actors or actresses, one thing we've commented in a couple of these other films, like we said it in the 39 Steps, right? Like how we liked like all of the different side characters and the different things that come across from that. And we've had different, you know, similar sentiments to a number of Hitchcock films. How do you feel like this worked from a supporting cast standpoint? Like, did you find each one of them just as interesting as the other? Do you think it helped with the pace of the film as far as like how we're navigating the story? Because I know you said, you know, not a lot happens, but we are going from like window to door to apartment, et cetera. Like, how do you think that all works in this film?
Yeah. And I guess maybe not a lot happens is the wrong phrase. Not a lot of plot happens. A lot of things happen, but I do like, you know, this is obviously Jimmy Stewart's show for the most part. He's pretty much in, I think he's in every scene, or at least in some ways. I think he's obviously fantastic. He's an all-time actor, but I really was impressed with Grace Kelly once again. You know, she was great in the, you know, last film we covered, but even better here. I thought she was given much more room to be like a character. Mm-hmm. And her relationship with Jimmy Stewart, I thought, was fascinating and like oddly modern. They're have this weird relationship where obviously she wants to go further than him in the sense of getting married, but like they're able to kind of still come to some sort of agreement in a way. And I was kind of glad like it didn't have that classic Hollywood ending, where it's not like this is ending with them getting married. Maybe that's where it's heading, but I found their relationship. And I also thought Thelma Ritter, who was Stella, she was that good comic relief. You know, she brought a lot of, you know, she was a good foil, you know, kind of just telling him how it is. And then her getting into it and like her actually getting invested in this, you know, potential murder, I think even sold it even more. Like, I think seeing these characters get so enthralled in this mystery, and I at a point too was thinking like, well, this is also somewhat speaking to the conspiracy theory mindset that exists so much, how individuals will take like a piece of information, you know, construct something around it. Even when they're given counter information that shows that's potentially wrong, they still, they're just so, the conspiracy is so great that they don't want to give it up, but then it ends up actually being true. So like, maybe that's not the best way of bringing it, but, I do think it, I like the characters here. Even some of the characters that, like the little snippets we get of people. You know, even like the newlywed couple, they walk in, they put the sheets down, and you know, it's just all these little small pieces of this world. Like, you know, the idea of world building is so overused, but this does a lot of that, and most of it just through, you know, watching people live their lives.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I have like a special place in my heart for, I guess, some of these supporting casts, because I think it's just fantastic casting, first of all. Like, obviously, they don't know that some of this is going to happen later, but like having the musician be Ross Bagdasarian, the senior, not junior, like he goes on to create Alvin and the Chipmunks, like, and he is the person that writes that, like, creates those characters. Obviously his son is the one that like does the series that we're familiar with in the '80s.
Yeah.
But like just having him be like that character and then seeing how his life ends up like almost mimicking some of the stuff that he's doing in that respect. Like, I feel like that's awesome. And I am a huge Perry Mason fan and Ironside fan. So like Raymond Burr being in this, even if he's the quote unquote villain, like I loved that, because this is before he's Perry Mason. Like, he he does a lot of stuff obviously before this as well, but like he's not that character until a few years after this. So like I loved seeing some of those like snippets of like, oh, like I know what these two folks are gonna go on to do and be. And he does play, I think Raymond Burr too, like is a, he fits that character well. Like he's got the right body size and shape, like to just come across as intimidating and menacing, whether you're buying into what's being alleged or not. Like you're like, well, I can buy it. Like you wouldn't have been so quick to buy into it, I guess, if it was just like, I don't know, a tiny little person, you know, or someone like that, or someone that didn't have that like menacing appearance. So I thought that was well done. And I just think each one like really was getting in and having fun with what their role was. And I think I 100% agree with you. I haven't seen all of Grace Kelly's work. Like I know she has done a ton of stuff, and I know she was, you know, one of the most famous people in Hollywood, and I've only seen a handful of films of hers, but like, I can hardly picture her being better than what she is in this. I'm not saying it's not out there, but like, this is like incredible. Like she's fantastic in this. Jimmy Stewart is obviously a fantastic actor, but you know, even if we just compare it to like Jimmy Stewart in this, Jimmy Stewart in Rope, like that's maybe not fair, but like he's just phenomenal in this compared. And I think he's the right person to cast for this, because you buy the fact that he's not wooed by this, you know, at the time probably one of the most sought after, or like the prototypical, like this is the movie star, like Grace Kelly, like this is like the people that makes all the guys' heads turn when she walks in a room. And he does a good job pulling off this guy that's like, yep, I appreciate that, but about this thing that I'm obsessed with, or about my work, or about whatever it is, like. So I just think it was perfect casting, like all across the board.
Yeah, and I think that was important too, because you saw he did have this obsessive personality, because he was so obsessed with his work that even like he wouldn't give it up even for someone like Grace Kelly. And I think that gave you, but then also made you wonder, you know, is he actually just, is he becoming obsessed with this now, like this potential mystery? So, and obviously obsession is a big piece of this, but
you see him too, he gets super excited when he reels in, I don't remember which order it is, but he basically reels in Grace Kelly's Lisa character into being a part of this, right? Like at one point she buys him and she's like, I'm 100% on board, I'm helping you with this, I'm supporting you with this. And then he does the same thing with Stella, like you mentioned. So one at a time, or almost simultaneously, I guess, he gets both of them on board. And the close-ups that they show of him, and some of the facial expressions that you see from him when he's not in it on his own anymore, and he's got one of these or two of these folks like in it, like he's just like a kid in a candy store. And it's kind of interesting to watch.
And you know, and of course the use of the camera certainly says a lot, because I get, you know, the idea of watching individuals, and you can certainly expound upon that, like what's it saying regarding that as you're watching a movie of someone watching something, and you know, looking for those and hoping, you know, even commenting on like the way that they were becoming so fascinated, almost like disappointed when maybe there wasn't a killer, and they were sad about it. But then at the same time, you're watching a movie, and if there wasn't someone that was ended up being the killer, or there's some sort of murder mystery, would you also be disappointed? So I think Hitchcock certainly loves to play with the audience in a lot of different ways, and this might be the most, you know, meta before meta was a thing, way of kind of approaching it.
Well, because the other way, like you said, like the way they're doing it, and I'll get into another thing you just said a second ago as well, but the way they're filming this, which is basically 100% from Jeffrey's apartment.
Yeah.
It puts the viewer, it forces the viewer to also be voyeuristic, right? Like you are feeling everything that he's wanting you to feel, because he's forced you to, whether you decide to or not, subconsciously or whatever, like you are doing everything that Jeffries is doing. You're watching everything that he's watching. You're getting invested in these different characters and wanting to know more about their stories, or trying to put two and two together with is this a murder or not. So it's like he's tricked you into being this character, which number one makes it harder for you to judge Jeffries, because you're doing it along with him. And number two, it just like from the suspense standpoint, like you're there because of how he's film this and without changing to another apartment or giving you other perspectives or point of views, like you have no choice almost but to like follow along. And the craziest thing for me is that I know we somewhat knew what was going to happen and probably had a little bit of a framework going into the rewatch. I was, and this is not hyperbole because I hate it when people say this and I don't find it always 100% truthful, but like I was like literally on edge watching this in the last third because I was trying to, my hardest number one to remember, because I'm like, why can't I remember everything that's about to happen? I know like this and this, but like, how does it all come together? And like, I was actually like literally 100% invested and like not on the edge of my seat necessarily, because I was sitting in a bed, but I was like very like tense. I was definitely tense and like wanting to see exactly how this resolved itself, even though I've already seen the movie. And I was like, wow, how did he do that to me? Like, I've already seen this and I was still like, I was feeling the suspense. So it worked for me from that standpoint.
Definitely, especially when they go over to the room and least she gets stuck. It is, because there's that helplessness of being so far away and just like, oh no, there's that is so suspenseful. And part of me too was like, I was like, did he do it? Like, I kept in my mind thinking there was an additional twist and it wasn't him, it was someone else. But I might be, clearly I was. So I kept like playing this game in my mind where, like, even though I watched it before, I kept questioning myself, which made it even more enjoyable, oddly enough.
Yeah. And the only thing I could remember is I know Raymond Burr goes over to Jeffrey's apartment. Like, I know Raymond Burr ends up in his apartment. And I was like, but I can't remember if he actually had done it or what he does when he gets there or how that all happens. And it's interesting how Hitchcock, first of all, if Hitchcock would have made it so that there was no murder, that would have been the biggest twist in that he could have possibly pulled off, because we know how much he loves murder and having it in all of his films. Like, that would have been like the switcheroo of all switcheroos to have this whole thing and then be no murder. That would have flabbergasted me. But like, there's a couple things that like just really build that suspense, because one by one, number one, he takes all of the people out of Jeffrey's apartment right before Thorwald goes over there. So you have the suspense that now you have somebody that's crippled at the moment with his broken leg by himself in this apartment. And we know nothing in this movie, like there's no doors that are locked basically. So you know, like that door, somebody can just walk in. So you have that suspense of like, I know he's there and he's helpless for the most part. You also have the fact that there's a very cool sequence where they show Lisa standing in the window on whatever level floor that is. I think that's the second floor. And then you have Miss Lonelyheart standing in the window on the bottom floor.
Yeah.
And they're almost in the exact same pose. So you also have the suspense of not only is Lisa over in that apartment and potentially at risk, but you have the fact that you also know what's going on in the bottom floor if somebody doesn't get to her quickly. And it's just an interesting way that they kind of like do all of that. Like it goes from, I don't know if I'd say it's from 0 to 60, but it definitely ramps up there in that last, like however many minutes that is. And it had me hook, line and sinker, I guess, again. Maybe if I watch it again in 5 years, it won't have that same effect on me, but it, I guess 20 years off was enough for me to forget enough to be tense during that whole time.
Yeah. It's incredible how much patience this is. Honestly, like a lot of Hitchcock movies, there's a lot of patience. Maybe it's just a different style years later, but really like that, the pieces we're talking about are like the last 15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Like it's a lot of just the questioning and like, just seeing what's happening, and it doesn't really get into the actual true suspense climax. It's like the last 15 minutes or so. And it makes it all worth it, because at that point, it feels almost cathartic because you're finally getting there. But also, even when you're there, you're still wondering, like, is there going to be another twist or something like that,
right,
or where it's going? And who knew, like, a flashlight could be your ultimate weapon? But
yeah,
it worked.
Saved by your craft, I guess. It was. I felt like it was, I guess, as much as 0 to 60 as that merry-go-round is in maybe not quite that crazy. But another thing that I think they do very well is using the character of Lieutenant Doyle in a way that really like solidly dispels most of the stuff they're coming up with, right? Like, it goes back to that thing that you're talking about, like, when you have a conspiracy theory, or it's like the same as like when people try to use statistics to support a position, which can almost always be done, right? Like, we can twist the numbers around to make it like fit our thing, or if you're looking for something that supports an outcome versus looking at the data to then inform your outcome. Like, so you have that thing going on where they're obsessed, like we talked about, and he's going to find a way to make it so it's still real, so it's still, and I think the way that they have it where the lieutenant pretty substantially like refutes a lot of the stuff. It's not just like it's not like a police officer comes in or a detective comes in that's just like, I don't have time for this, I'm just blowing this off, like, I don't believe you. It's like, we checked this is this, like, A connects to B connects to C, like, you guys are crazy. And yeah. And it's very believable the way that that is written and the way that the dialogue is delivered and like how that all goes. Like, it doesn't, like, I'm thinking of Dial M for Murder, where the detective in that one, you're questioning, even if he was playing like a longer game, I guess, like, you're watching him and saying like, wait, what? Like, how are you not seeing this? Or why are you acting in this way? And in this situation, it was like, he's got some points. Like, I think y'all might be some crazy folks. So I think that player or that character of the lieutenant is played very well in the storytelling of this and the plot development of this to like make you question not only Jimmy Stewart's character, but like yourself too. And like, but like what you were talking about, is there really a murder? Is there really something that we're going to find out?
Yeah, it wasn't a movie that made you mad because the police weren't doing their job. It's like, he actually went above and beyond. He went, right. beyond, you know, so, but it also, but then the way Jimmy Stewart's able to kind of pick it apart, but it does feel like it becomes more and more desperate. And the way that back and forth works throughout, that is really great. So,
yeah, I agree. And the way that they use the, I don't know, I guess there is some conveniences as far as like the phone calls and how fast everybody can get to the different people's apartments and whatnot, but like, I didn't really, that was neither here nor there. I was interested though to ask you a couple things. So that I know for a fact, I haven't read the short story, but I know for a fact that they changed two things, and I'm interested in your take on it. So obviously Grace Kelly's character does not exist in the short story. How much do you think that character and the performance adds to, obviously it adds a lot because we get to see her, Grace Kelly, perform in a fantastic way. Like, I get that. But from a story and a plot standpoint, how much do you think her character adds to this story versus the short story who doesn't have the love interest for Jeffries?
I think it adds a lot. Like we mentioned, it shows just his obsessive nature, because for many people, be like, you have an opportunity to marry Grace Kelly, you do it. But for him, he's so enthralled with being a photographer and the life he can bring him and that excitement, that it makes all the more sense that he'd be desperate to find it again when the issue presents itself. If that wasn't there, then it's like, where it would feel like all that was happening in a bit of a like less inorganic way. But here it gives you so much insight to who he is as a character that makes you also question, like, again, is he just leading into it because of his need for that exciting opportunity to witness something that's crazy and something that is, you know, earth-shattering? Or is there something there? So without that piece, without her being there, without, like, having that relationship, I think that you lose a lot there. And then, like I said, I think their interaction was... When you lose also one of the most exciting scenes in the movie when she's, so I think you would lose a great deal without her.
I agree that as well. I think there is too, like, some analyzing where that's another facet of a relationship that's not represented by any of the people they're watching, where you have the two people that clearly are interested in each other, but like, whether it be their jobs or some type of something's holding them back, maybe the fear of commitment, maybe the, I just don't want to give up my lifestyle and my job. But like, that's something that we don't necessarily see from any of the couples that we're watching, that I can think of. Another thing that they change in the short, so I don't know, again, I don't think this would work either, because I think it adds a lot of suspense to the film Rear Window, but in the short story, it's not revealed that Jeffries has a broken leg until the last line of the book for the story. And I find that intriguing. Like, I find it intriguing to be like, wow moment at the end to like make you think back of everything that you've read. But I can't imagine it's as suspenseful if you know that he doesn't, you know what I mean? If you know that he has that broken leg. Like, I don't know how they deal with the sequence. I don't even know if there is a sequence where the guy comes over or any of that type of stuff, but I did find that an interesting thing that you wouldn't know about that until the end. I guess it could help justify something that you're wondering why he's just watching out the window for everybody. And like,
yeah,
it would have a different experience if you know that he's not laid up like that. But what do you think about that?
I don't, yeah, I guess I have to really obviously read the story to understand the context of what it was going for compared to this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just going for something different, but I don't see how you could do that in this, in the movie at all. And I feel like if it was just revealed at the end, I think throughout the movie, you'd just be more frustrated with him. why are you just like do something like, you know, like,
right.
Why are, so yeah, I think you'd lose a lot without that piece.
Yeah.
But again, like it could be just that the short story was going for a different,
might be, yeah, 100%.
Might be focus or something like that.
Right. Yeah. So obviously we get some Hitchcock things in this film, right? We have the Hitchcock blonde and Grace Kelly. We have the use of the camera work, like we've said, like he likes to be very creative in how he constructs that and does that. We don't have any moms in this one, so there's nothing with that. We don't have somebody that's guilty that we're following, or that's not guilty that's being accused of something, but we are still following something, that someone that's trying to get away with something in a way. But I don't know if I've pulled as many of the, I guess, the Hitchcockian things that we're supposed to be seeing here and there in some of his films as much as I've seen in some of the other ones. Is there anything that you picked up on that you had a connective tissue to some of the other films we've watched?
Well, you'll of course get his cameo,
yes,
where he shows up, like fixing the clock.
I
was watching this wondering, like, is he going to be able to, you know, get himself in the movie? And he does. And I think one thing we have seen in a couple of, you know, Rope and even, you know, Dial for Murder, which was a lot of movies that just take place in a limited location, maybe not just one room. And this, of course, it's obviously not just one room, but it is like one specific location. So I think that is something we're seeing. And then there's other movies that do that too, that we're not covering, like Lifeboat. So I think that is like him controlling a location or using location to benefit the story is clearly something that he is like a master at. And this is probably, you know, the magnum opus when it comes to that feature.
Yeah. And we've also seen, this is not necessarily what we were just talking about, but like I'm thinking of like the legacy of this film and like what it did for the future of cinema and like different things and how they would play with that. And like, and just from a story standpoint, like how many times has another movie tried to do this in a way?
Yeah.
Like they've done the voyeuristic like person, like there was literally one just a year or two ago where the, I'm blanking on it. I think it's Zoe Kravitz, isn't it? Maybe, or somebody where she's like, it's a little bit more futuristic where technology plays a lot bigger thing and whatnot, but like where you're seeing somebody from across an apartment room or from whatever, mm-hmm. and you're, you know, there, you see something bad, like obviously you're going to see something bad happen or you're suspecting something's bad happening. And like, how do you do that? So like we see it over and over again in the film world, which is interesting. I don't know how many times it was done before this one, but obviously this one like seems like it's like the one that like set that trend off of like, hey, you can really build some auto, like you have built in suspense if you set it up with this type of like voyeuristic setting, I guess, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did any other films come to your mind that like are a take on this that you've recognized over the last 10, 20 years?
There is that, was it Suburbia that, what's his name? I can't think of his name. Shia LaBeouf movie where mm-hmm. he's stuck at home because of like a house arrest or whatever, and has one of the creepiest things in the world where I think, was it Megan Fox? I can't remember if it was Megan Fox or
another actor. I think you might be right. It sounds right.
But she like, he says something that I've been staring and watching you. And she was like, mm-hmm. that is the greatest thing ever. It's like, that is a weird way. But honestly, the first thing my mind goes to is the Simpsons episode, Bark of Darkness, Bart of Darkness, I think it's called, where he's, you know, his latest broken, he's going through a similar thing because, of course, the Simpsons did it. So that's right. Honestly where my mind goes first is the Simpsons parody.
There's another one with, I don't remember if it's Amy Adams or if it's somebody who's got like a condition where they can't, like they can't leave the apartment or something of that nature because of some type of like a fear of the outside world, and then trying to deal with what she sees and helping in a way, but she's afraid to go outside of her apartment. So yeah, it's obviously been done in a number of different ways. Was there any other little tidbits that you noticed in Rear Window, trivia bits or anything that you haven't been able to point out yet that you wanted to share?
No, that was pretty much it. You mentioned the didactic music. That's mm-hmm. You mentioned that I found that when I first watched it, I never noticed it, but knowing it the second time, it's like, it becomes so obvious. And, it is so keen on, creating that atmosphere, but I had nothing else.
The only other a little bit of trivia that I thought was somewhat interesting, which came out in this special feature on the DVD, it was the they do some interviews with the character that plays Miss Torso, Georgine Darcy, and she was commenting on the fact that the couple that sleeps outside on their mattress on the balcony,
oh yeah,
on one of the upper floors, how she said basically Hitchcock intentionally, I'm sure, did this. Some people claim it was like a little prank, but I feel like he was doing it for like authenticity. But basically, he filmed everything from, he was in Jeffrey's apartment apparently like the whole time. Like, I don't know if it was 100% of the time, but basically the whole time. And then he had people that were like in the other places that he could talk to, like on an earpiece or whatever, to relay directions to the different actors or different things that were happening in each of the apartment windows, rooms, or whatever. And so apparently he had given one of the couple the earpiece to give directions to, gave his directions to how he wanted the sequence to go when they're getting rained on and they have to move the mattress inside. And then after he gave all the directions to the guy, let's say, he told the guy to give the earpiece to the girl so he could give her the directions, and then gave her a completely different set of directions so that they would like really be struggling with like which way to go and how to get that inside, to the point where like when he falls through the window, that's not even in the script. That's just because like they were so discombobulated at that point. So I give him kudos for like thinking of doing stuff like that, where it's going to like build some like actual authentic struggle with those two.
Yeah.
So I think stuff like that's just like chef's kiss, I guess, but like it's why Hitchcock is who he is. So
also makes me wonder like how they even did the whole rain sequence, because like just
they said that they had to build like one of the most intricate or complex drainage tunneling in the set to make sure that like all the water would flow out during that rain sequence. I didn't like get a lot of details, but apparently that was another part of the crazy set that they build, was to accommodate for that rain sequence.
Yeah, because I can imagine.
Right. And then just the only other tidbit, this was a budget of $1 million and box office was 37.9, which in today's world would be about 316 million if we adjusted for inflation. So I guess that would be quite the success when you make 38 times your budget.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
go Hitchcock and go everybody involved in 1954. So any last words or final thoughts on Rear Window, Dan?
I got nothing. I would say, you know, if you're looking to watch one Hitchcock film, I think you couldn't go wrong with this. And I, you know, always worry when you get a movie like this, that's get, you know, are you going to set up so many different expectations that it's going to just disappoint? And maybe it will for some, but I think like I said, if you just look at it's just creation, it's hard to, you know, just not agree just how amazing this is as a movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I came out of this appreciating it even more than I thought. I'm hoping that's going to be the same for our next episode, where we're going to go 4 years later into 1958, where we're going to talk about one of the other most lauded and appreciated Hitchcock films, which is, of course, Vertigo. And also we'll see Jimmy Stewart one more time. So just before we close, Dan, I know you've seen Vertigo before. How long has it been, and what are you looking forward to with this rewatch?
That was, it was less than that. I think it was like 8 or so years ago. And to be honest, I remember watching when I watched it the first time, I don't remember much of it, but I remember not being as impressed with it compared to, you know, Rear Window or some of the other films I've enjoyed more. So I'm interested in going back to see, well, I like it more. Like, you know, I know with, look at a movie like Rope, which disappointed me, will Vertigo, because, you know, I think a lot of people put Vertigo above Rear Window, above North by Northwest. And I remember when I saw it, I didn't feel that way. So,
and I had the exact same feeling. So I'm very intrigued with, as we're going through this series, how it's going to resonate and if it resonates more than it did the first time. It's been about the same time period for me. My mom and I watched both of these somewhat, not back to back, but in the same time period. And I had a similar reaction where I was like, okay, I get it with Rear Window. Like, I understand why people say the things that they do. And then I watched Vertigo and I was like, did I miss something? Not that it's bad in any way, but I was like, to me, it was clear that Rear Window was the better film for me personally when I watched it the first time. And I'm interested to see if that holds true or if Vertigo will surprise me and jump up on my list here after the rewatch.
Yeah, and I hate heights too, so I'm like, it's got me that way. So see how there it goes the second time.
Yeah. All right, so that does it for this episode of the Cinema Geeks. You can keep in touch with us and keep tabs on what we're doing by following all of the different social media. If you want to follow Dan, you can search out the Comic Concierge on all social media platforms. Basically, I think you're on just about all of them, Dan. There may be one missing, but
I'm not on Tumblr. I'm not there, if that's still a thing.
So. No Tumblr, but if you no MySpace, but if you're on any of the other ones, you can find the Comic Concierge there and all of his comic content. You can find me by searching out the Geek Showcase on YouTube or Optimus Solo on the social media platforms, and then you can search out the show. Obviously, that is the Cinema Geeks or our home, the Geekcast Radio Network. You can go to the website or follow all of their social handles as well. So that does it for this episode of the Cinema Geeks. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to us talk more about Hitchcock with the classic Vertigo.